Okay, folks, we are hit the magic witching hour, so 7:30. I will go ahead and mute all, and everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a comment or a question, or remute yourself afterwards. We have a good crowd with us tonight. If we have any new people with us tonight, by all means, if you want to join as a guest, that's no problem. If you want to become a member, if you go to our website, I'll paste it into the chat as well. But if you go to our website and click on the Join or Renew link at the top, it's only $20 a year. We'd be happy to add you to our membership rolls. So, yeah, tonight's presentation will go up on our website, both or all three of the PDF of the deck that is presented. The chat window and the audio track will go up later on this evening at some point, so feel free to download those files if you want to be able to review anything. And with that, I will kick it over to Alan to take us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Hey, thanks, Chris. So we're going to start off with a blast from the past. Last week, Tom had volunteered to do a thing on Firefox extensions, but we ran out of time. So I'm going to kick it off this week with this presentation from Tom, and Tom is going to share his screen and give us the benefit of his wisdom. Once he unmutes himself.
Okay, I guess I'm unmuted now, and yep. I need to share my screen. Yes. Sure. So you should see all that.
There we go.
Yes, indeed.
And let's go to presenter mode on another screen. So what is U-Matrix? U-Matrix is another add-in from the guy who wrote U-Block Origin that allows you a kind of a deeper look at what's in every page without getting into the details, but all the resources it accesses. So what U-Matrix is about seeing all that and also controlling what your browser accesses. So here's an example. This is the primary panel that U-Matrix shows. This shows the different domains that are on the accessed by the web page. At the bottom, you'll see there's 13 blacklisted host names because it also will immediately blacklist. You can unblacklist them for a particular page, but it comes out with there's a blacklist that is maintained that it's there. And the things you can do with them are cookie, CSS, image, plugin, zip. I'll go into those. So it's about each of these cells here you can actually change the color of. So let's get to the next one. This is the settings. Well, I don't really touch any of these, so your experience may vary from mine. But I haven't touched any of these. There's nothing that I see or need to change. So what are the purposes? The first one is to preserve your privacy, to control tracking via cookies or resource usage, like those 1 pixel images that track you and then track emails and so on. Those you can see them showing up. It also protects from malware by importing host files of bad domains. Those are those blacklisted ones. And you can see and control what a domain may access. One domain or all, you can turn off temporarily or permanently. These are permanently means for that web, for that domain that you're actually, that owns the page that you're accessing. You can also control separately by domain and or resource, cookies, style sheets, images, plugins, scripts, script resources, frames, which are subparts of a page that show up, and other. The default is to allow nothing but domain resources, i.e. the domain of the page you're on, and all CSS and images, and to blacklist malware. As you can see here in this one, the green square means that they're effectively, if they're solid green, They're effectively whitelisted. Requests are allowed to reach their destination. So these are all allowed. Same thing for CSS and images. From the blacklisted host names, nothing is allowed. So these are the domains. There's more domains above here, so I don't know what the original page domain is. But these domains are allowed. And of course all the subdomains are articulated here. And ditto for these are the ones that are not allowed. And you can change this, which I will show you. So a dark green square is specifically whitelisted. So these are specifically whitelisted. And of course, when CSS and image are specifically whitelisted, then everything below them is whitelisted. The faded green square means it's inherited because the entry is gray listed, which is these faded green squares. The red square is effectively blacklisted. The pink squares are effectively blacklisted. The dark red squares are deliberately blacklisted. And a faded red square is inherited because the entry is gray listed. In this case, it's pink listed, I guess. So let's go into a demo. And let's pick up France. So this is France 24. They have an English site. It's their broadcasting effort. This is the widget for U-Matrix. So if I click that, you'll see this. And there's a whole bunch of, these are all the first party ones. And, this is new. I haven't seen that. It says first party, just to be obvious. So France24.com is where we are. If you go look here, we're at France24.com. And these are the ones that are pink listed or gray listed, as the previous slide said. And what you can do for each of these, you can blacklist them. You can blacklist for each domain. Well, this is green listing, I thought. But if you notice the green and the pink, you can also blacklist. So now if I reload this page, they're not picked up. Let's try to do it without the browser cache by control F5. And as you can see now, the images are, none of the images show here because I've effectively blacklisted by the first party here. If I do it this way, if I click the bottom side of this, everything is red listed. This is the dark colors are where you have specifically clicked or which come as the default. CSS and image are deliberately green listed or white listed. And I and the first party is deliberately green listed. But you can turn these on and off. If I turn this whole thing off, then nothing will show. I can also turn it back on again, and everything's on. And if I reload, we get our pictures back. These things I don't know about, but if Privacy Center, I think this is a cookie request. Let's allow it. Reload. Well, if it is, it doesn't show up. And this thing, you can also do it. You can also, of course, turn on or off individual cells. So that's how it works. It's useful for seeing what other things a web page is looking at, and you control its access to that. I use it. If you have it on all the time, then it can be a pain because everything except the first party ends up being pinked, and so you don't access that, and you have to turn it on for each new domain that you access. But these things last for the domain as long as you're accessing that web page. So if we go on and go back to the slideshow, this is a demo. And I'd like to credit SlideGo for giving me the slide backgrounds for everything. And I'm done.
We had an interesting question here from Karen. How do you know what each does and whether it's important to your viewing or not?
By turning it on and off. There's no other way.
Yeah. And as you showed, sometimes you'll turn it off and it won't be apparent anyways, right? So it'll be some background sort of thing that you don't even notice whether something is happening or not.
Yeah, and often I turn off scripts and leave other stuff. It's the scripts that are mainly the dangerous things if you're worried about being either spied on or hacked.
But then scripts can be important to the display of the page as well, right?
Absolutely. Most of the pages display. Well, pages display is determined by basically two things, the CSS, the style sheets, and the scripts. Everything else is kind of content. Oh, and the frame. Frames are things like where you have that movie playing in YouTube. That movie is actually in a, that video is actually in a frame. I don't know what other is. Maybe they don't either. But it's yeah. But it's scripts and CSS that affect how things are shown on a page. Frames are basically boxes on a page, on the page you're looking at.
Just to mention why scripts can be really important. One of the cruise lines, they do absolutely everything through JavaScript. So if you don't have scripting running, you end up with totally blank pages.
Uh-huh.
Which I don't think is very smart of them, but who knows? Maybe most people don't ever turn off scripting. Do we have any other questions for Tom before we go on? Okay, thanks a lot, Tom. That was a good overview of it to show what it can do, and everybody can try it out and see if it works for them to improve their browsing online.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks very much, Tom. And Tom's slides will be will be on the website later on tonight, probably. Okay, so moving along, Chris has a follow-up on the YouTube help item that we had last week.
Yeah, so last week, Linda gave a presentation on YouTube Health, and it's designed to supposedly allow Google, who owns YouTube, to elevate reliable health information. And Karen had an interesting question. Next. So she said she liked that it is trying to put integrity and trust into what you see on health information, and she was wondering how they actually accomplish this. And then the secondary question was, in their proposed validation, is the proposed validation correct, true, unmanipulated, and how would anybody actually know or verify that it is actually true, unmanipulated, and correct information that we're actually getting? Next. And then an extra question, which I'm going to cover off as a separate sort of entity, is what safeguards are in place to ensure that numbers are not manipulated by bots? As we all know, you know, if you go onto YouTube and you look, they tend to elevate videos that have lots of views. Well, you can actually get bots to actually elevate your numbers artificially. And so does that affect YouTube Health? And I'll have some other things to say about bots as well. Next. So the first part, how YouTube Health is, quote unquote, putting integrity and trust into their system. Next. So I went on their site and I started digging down a little bit into it. And so you can go to YouTube Health and it will have all kinds of information about the program itself. I highly recommend that you actually dig around a little bit on there if you are interested in this specific idea of, are you getting reliable help and information on YouTube Health? Because there is a lot of information on there. In one part, they talk about if you want to actually be a content provider that is part of YouTube Health and hopefully getting promoted because of that, you have to be a licensed medical professional, either a doctor or a nurse, or you have to be an organization that is involved with health. So it'd be, Mount Sinai Hospital or, things like that, or Ottawa Public Health could you know, be a, an organization that is dealing with medical information. You have to have a YouTube channel, and that YouTube channel has to be focused on health information. And they do have a minimum number of views, but they don't specify what that minimum number actually is. And then you have to actually apply to be part of the program, which presumably they will then use to you know, validate that you are a medical professional or an organization, that you do have a YouTube channel, all the other things that need to be part part and parcel of the program. Next. So I dug around a little bit more to see about, you know, what other indicators are there that this information could actually be trusted or promoted. And in their FAQ section, they say, why should I apply to this feature? I've bolded some things that I thought stood out as being important aspects of it. So it has to be identified as an authoritative health source. How they do that, I'm not exactly sure. There will be an information panel containing context for the users that the videos they're watching are from licensed healthcare professionals. I'm not sure that they're all that successful in doing that. Additionally, your videos will be eligible to show up on a health sources shelf at or near the top of the search. So it always ends up on the first page that you will see a shelf, and I have a screenshot of it later, of so it'll be on the first page, and it scrolls horizontally to additional pages that you can't necessarily see when it first comes up. Next. So I looked at some things on there, doing some searches and that, and quite frankly, I did not see any difference in the results that came from a particular search, whether it was from Johns Hopkins Medicine, which I would presume is considered an authoritative health source, or a CNN news report, which I would not necessarily consider to be authoritative health source, or Novartis. And I'm not sure how much I would trust information from a drug company. And in particular, there are some notes in on the YouTube Health website that specifically excludes drug companies from being part of YouTube Health. Next. So another question or FAQ is what is the expected impact of being part of the program? So why would a professional want to be part of the program? So they say all videos will get a label that helps users understand your license. Interesting. Or that your organization has a licensed healthcare professional. Okay. Videos that are relevant to the health search will be eligible to appear on that health sources shelf. Next. Now, I didn't see any label that helps users understand your license. I couldn't see that anywhere. Maybe it's there and it's just the way it's displayed is not really evident, but I saw no evidence of that really. And I do see videos on the From Health Sources shelf. But the problem with that from my perspective is that unless I was to actually read up on YouTube Health, I had no clue that that From Health Sources shelf actually meant anything. So there's no indication on there that there's any vetting going on or that they're part of a program if they appear there or anything like that. Next. So here's an example where I did a search for vaccination information. And the top hit was from the Faculty of Health Sciences at the University of Pretoria, probably eligible to be part of the program. Whether they are or not, I don't know. There were only 2,800 views over a three-year period. Not a lot. Next. The next hit was New York University, probably also, you know, something that is a trustworthy source. 611 views over 2 years. Next. Here's that for From Health Sources shelf. And now if you look at it, there's no indication on there that says these have been vetted. You can consider them to be more trustworthy than other things that you'll see there, or that they're part of a program that requires a validation or anything like that. And you can go horizontally. So you see three videos, but there'll be a chevron pointing off to the right. You can click on those to get extra ones. But again, I'm not sure. But having read from the YouTube Health website, it might be the best indicator of trusted information. I'm really not sure. Next. And then we have Animated Biology with Arpan. I have absolutely no idea who those people are. 41,000 views over 4 years. Next.
Just before you go on, Linda's put a note here that YouTube channel has a minimum of 1,500 public watch hours on the channel in the last 12 months, or 1.5 million valid public shorts views in the past 90 days.
Okay, that's really interesting then. Yeah, so some of these 1,500 public views in 12 months, that's not a lot of views, I don't think. 1.5 million in 90 days, maybe. Yeah, but that's an example there that I presume that Linda found that on the YouTube Health website. I didn't find that. So, you know, it's just, to me, it's bizarre. So next
1,500 hours, though, Chris.
Oh, 1,500 hours, sorry. Yeah, okay. That makes a difference. So next. So two of them, from my perspective, two are from recognizable sources. All of them, I think, have pitifully low views over a very long period of time. And I only think that shelf from health sources actually means anything, and only because I read YouTube Health website. So to me, it was not a terribly successful sort of test to see just how this is providing, you know, useful, validated information for me. Next. So I think that the background processes for YouTube Health are pretty opaque. They have some rules about it, but they say they're going to do things and they don't seem to be doing it. They could be elevating content from reliable sources. I don't know. I don't see any real evidence of that, except for maybe that shelf. That's the best that I've actually seen. Next. There is health information that is ranking high that is not so obviously reliable. So I do see on the first page and subsequent pages where you'll get health information that I have no way of saying that really looks like it's from a trusted source. People claiming to be doctors with millions of views, things like that, is not necessarily a reliable indicator of how valid the information might be. Next. So the process behind the ranking on YouTube are not clear, and I think quite possibly they never will be clear. Next. Okay, then the second part that Karen asked about was, can bots artificially elevate content on YouTube Health to make it appear that it's more reliable than it perhaps is? So this actually will apply to anything that is seen on YouTube. So this idea of bots elevating content could be a problem no matter what it is you're watching. It could be recipes. It could be travel information. It could be YouTube Health. So it does appear that views, a number of views, are influencing rankings at least in part. So the question is, what's to prevent someone from artificially increasing their ranking by buying views? Can bots be detected? And as I say here, this applies to much more than just YouTube Health. It applies to all of YouTube. Next. So I asked Perplexity AI, is there any way to know if YouTube views numbers have been inflated by bots? And this was actually an interesting response that I got from it. Next. So it did say that there are indicators that suggest that the view count may have been artificially inflated by bots. So this is indicators that YouTube would see as opposed to indicators that we would see as viewers or users on the platform. They do go on to say that no single factor is definitive proof that the view count has been inflated by bots. Next. So here they are. There's eight of them that they actually listed. One was subscriber to view ratio. So if you, they say that the typical ratio is about 8-12%, where people, 8-12% of views will be people who are subscribed to that particular channel. So if a channel has 10,000 subscribers and consistently gets 7,000 plus views, that might be an indication that it's been artificially inflated by bots that are not subscribed to the channel. Next. Engagement metrics. So this is videos that with artificially inflated views often lack engagement in the form of likes, comments, shares, so forth. So they're just views. They're not people that are actually engaging with the content at all. So high view count, very few likes or comments could be a red flag. Next. Audience retention. Typically, bots will only watch a video for a couple of seconds. They won't watch it through to the end. So if your retention shows that there is a sharp drop off after the first few seconds rather than watching through to the end of the video, then that could be an indication of bot activity. Again, these are things that you won't see, but Google can definitely see. Next. Traffic sources. Now, this one here, I didn't quite understand this one, quite frankly. An unusually high percentage of views from external sources can be suspicious. I do include the link later on where you can get this information, but quite frankly, I didn't really understand this even after reading the source data on it. So next. Sudden spikes in views. So if you have an unexplained increase in view count, doesn't correspond with anything else that might have driven it, that could be a sign of bot activity as well. So if you have a channel that's not watched very much, and then all of a sudden a new video gets posted, no evidence that it's getting promoted in any way, and it has 10,000 views in a day, well, maybe it's bot activity. Next. Inconsistent growth. If the subscriber count is stagnant and the view count skyrockets, yeah, that could be an indication of artificial inflation as well by bots. Next. Low watch time. This actually corresponds with one of the previous ones I had on the audience retention. So if the watch time is really low, it could be bot activity as well. And finally, unusual viewer demographics. So if the demographics don't align with content or target audience, could be a sign of bot activity. Now, that could be disturbing a little bit that that Google could actually understand the viewer demographics and know that I, for example, may be very unlikely to be viewing bird watching or something like that. I find it a little disturbing that Google could tell that, but apparently they can. Next. So the indicators can raise suspicions. So as Perplexity AI said, no one indicator is proof. But if you see a lot that are adding up and adding up, it could be really, really a good indicator that, yes, it is bot activity. And YouTube, apparently they actively do work to detect and remove invalid traffic. Proxy AI said as bot technology evolves, detection becomes an ongoing challenge. So bots get smarter. For example, they could watch videos right through to the end rather than just watching 2 seconds and moving on. That sort of idea. I have references there for all of the things that Perplexity AI reference. The last one in particular I find actually very interesting. It's a YouTube video of a guy who wanted to test out whether you could artificially inflate numbers through bot activity. He started a brand new channel, not promoted through any other means at all, put up a couple of videos that were bland, not promoted anywhere, and watched for a couple of days, and he saw no hits on it at all. Nobody was viewing it. And then he went off into the marketplace, and he found a company that will, for a set price, will create a whole bunch of views. And sure enough, over a course of a couple of days, generated, I think, a couple of thousand views or something like that. And his YouTube channel got a very brief boost, and then his boost evaporated, presumably because YouTube looked at it, said, no, this is all bot activity, so we're not going to promote your channel because these are not real viewers. So really interesting viewing that last video on there for anybody who wants to look into that a little bit more. Next. So finally on this.
It answers Bob's question. He wants to know how to get bots to view his YouTube channel.
You can watch that video. He actually tells you, I think, the company that he used. But bear in mind that it didn't work for him, so it probably won't help for you either. So my final slide conclusions on it, going back to the YouTube health specifically, is it helping people find reliable health information on YouTube? To me, there's not a lot of clear indicators, at least for now. Next. Is YouTube health actually a work in progress? Well, I hope so. I mean, it seems they put a fair amount of work into developing the program, and the bones of the program seem to be interesting, solid, and reasonable. But it would be nice to see some of those promised clear labels, such as licensed healthcare professional, authoritative health source, things like that, that as you look at it, you can say, okay, somebody has vetted this information or the provider of this information and thinks that the information is reliable. Next. On the bot side of things, should we be concerned about bots elevating rankings? It appears that Google is actually doing a lot to prevent this. So they may get slight blips for a period of time, but those blips will go away. When you see a lot of views on a YouTube channel, it's probably because they're actually getting real views. Next. I'd like to extend a big thanks to Linda for bringing forward the YouTube health info in the first place, Karen for asking the follow-up questions. When I started looking into this, I thought it was going to be a five-minute job to find the information I was looking for. It turned into being a lot more than that, but it was very interesting digging down into this, and quite frankly, isn't that what Q&A is all about? So with that, I'm done with this item.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And next up, Karen actually came across a couple of interesting tips for people. So, Karen, you're going to talk to these slides?
Alan, if you can jump in too for some, because you've done a little bit more of the background on some of them than went beyond what I did when I sent it off to you. So that's great. So hi, everybody. Boy, it seems like I'm a question girl lately. So I have my desktop that I use Google Calendar with, and then I have an Android phone that I also have my Google Calendar with. And I have subscribed on my desktop to certain additional calendars so that I can get my appointments for various different medical practitioners. And when I went to look on my Android phone, they weren't syncing, and I couldn't figure out why. So I went on a little bit of a search to see how could I solve this. So I came across this really interesting and very short YouTube video that I thought was very succinct and very helpful. So in case anybody else is having this same problem, or maybe even not aware that they are having this problem, I thought I'd just do a little quick share on this. So Alan has put together these slides. Thank you very much, Alan, for doing that. So he has included the link to the YouTube video. And also in the next slide, if we go forward, Alan, the next slide are the various different steps in summary that the YouTube provides in order to get your calendars to sync between the desktop and the Android. So when you go into the Android, because that's the one that wasn't syncing for me, I click on my calendar app, I select settings, I select show more, and then for each individual calendar, I had to go in and select the enable sync. So that was for every different practitioner that wasn't showing when I did their calendar that they allowed me to do through the appointment booking system. This is how I got them to sync between my desktop and my Android and my Google Calendar.
Yeah, next up is Firefox.
So I thought, hey, wouldn't this be a fun thing to share during Q&A? So as I was about trying to select the different information, I came across this different thing in Firefox that I'd never seen and really don't know a lot about. So this is where I might get Alan to kick in, because that's where he did a little bit more digging and a little bit more research. So as I'm taking all of that information from the previous presentation I just gave, clicking and copying information to put in an email to send in the suggestion box, when I right-clicked in my Firefox on the link, in the menu, I saw this for the first time, copy without site tracking. I don't remember ever seeing that before, and I thought, hey, that's kind of cool. That's really interesting. I don't really know what that means. So I sent it off to the suggestion box, and then Alan very kindly has taken the research for the next bullet and highlighted a little bit more about what that means. So Alan, do you want to speak to that a little bit more?
I would, but I don't really understand what it does, quite honestly. Apparently, it's fairly recent. It came in version 1.20, and it's automatically enabled, so if you, it's in the menu. And basically, what it says is it strips tracking parameters from any URL that you copy. Now, that I don't understand, because if you copy a URL, I would have thought you were just copying text, pasting it into an email and sending it to your buddy. But maybe you can share URLs in a different way that leave additional information in the URL.
There's several ways you can track somebody opening a URL. The first one is you can add in things after the question mark. Track ID. If you look at Amazon links, often they'll have things with question mark after, and those are parameters that are passed to the web page and to the owner of the web page as to show the source of how the link came in. Also, in Google Alerts, if you get them, if you look in the URL for the alert, you'll see that it actually goes to Google first, and then it goes off to the actual link that has been alerted to you. So those are at least two ways that tracking is done inside of a URL.
Natalie asked the question, does it mean it strips the question mark and all the information after it? It wouldn't be all of that, because there are lots of parameters that could be passed through with a question mark. So I presume that they're not just eliminating everything. They're only looking for specific parameters that are being passed that allow it to say where you're being transferred from, I would guess, is what it really amounts to. I often, when I go in and I'm going to pass on a URL to something, I'll copy the entire URL, but then I'll look at it and I'll look, are there any question marks? And usually what I'll do is I will go to the first question mark in the URL, delete it and everything after it, and then test the URL to see if it still links to the page that I intend to pass on to somebody else. And if it does, I just pass on that, and I eliminate all of that other stuff that comes in, is usually the way that I pass on URLs.
Isn't that interesting? That's exactly what I've been doing for the Q&A slides, but I was doing it just to make the URL shorter.
Yeah, quite frankly, a lot of it, I was doing the same thing, and especially on Amazon links. Amazon links can be horrendously long. They can be like hundreds of characters long, and really the URL you need to point to a particular product or something like that is maybe 30 characters long or something like that. But there's a lot of information that can be passed on for sure with question marks.
Okay, right. So maybe I should start using Firefox, and then I can use this magic menu item.
So thank you all for the discussion, because I really didn't know what that meant, didn't have time to pursue it. I knew that there would be lots of minds behind this and people that know far more than I do about that, but I thought it was an interesting thing I'd never seen before. And with your discussion tonight, it's explained why I'm seeing these long URLs that I really hadn't even noticed or seen before, and what all that means. So thank you very much for that too. And also another thank you to Chris for diving down the rabbit hole with the previous question. All your time and effort. I didn't intend it for it to be anything like that, but learning so much from those last two things. So thank you all.
Thank you. Mavo has a question. Does it do the same for links that have double click as part of the URL? Personally, I don't know, but if you test it, if you use a different browser than Firefox and, you know, you get a URL that does have double click as part of it, it might be interesting if you then try in Firefox and see if it strips out that double click information out of it. Personally, I don't know if it does, but if anybody else has a definitive answer, by all means, speak up.
I don't know about double click, but there are add-ons for all browsers that will delete this stuff from links that are coming in. For example, if you do a Google search, I believe that most of the time on the search, it'll actually say it goes to Google first and then it goes off to the website so that Google can track actually which search item you chose. But I believe that at least the add-ons I have remove all that. So if I go to a Google search, it actually shows me the exact link to the place rather than Google blah, 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 and then the link.
Good stuff.
Okay. All right. So sticking with it.
If I may, sorry, just, and Alan, thank you very much for preparing the slides for me.
Alan does good slides.
Well, sticking with the theme of browsers, we're going to carry on with another item from Chris.
Yeah, this is a follow-up a little bit. Last week, I mentioned that I would actually come back with this addition, and it is useful, I find, for the manifest note-taker, but it is useful for anybody who wants to customize the new tab experience in every browser except, it seems, Vivaldi. So last week, I talked about the manifest browser note-taker, and all you have to do is go to manifest.app. And it'll show you your notes. But it's kind of handy, I think, if you actually have it. I mentioned you could bookmark it, change your homepage to it, or things like that. But no easy way for it to appear on the new tab when you click on that on the bar in the browser. Next. So what if you actually wanted Manifest to appear when you create a new tab? Or what if you want new tab to display a different web page or local HTML file. Most of the modern browsers prevent this from happening. You can't actually customize the new tab experience. The notable exception being Vivaldi, and you can actually go into settings tabs, new tab page, and you can customize that to your heart's content. But other ones don't allow you to do it. Next. So this is the experience with Chrome's new tab page. When you click on that, you do get a bunch of icons on the screen, which are typically automatically added to places that you frequent, or you can actually customize that and add a specific web page. But you still go to new tab, and then you have to click again to go to a particular icon that appears on that page. And next. So there is way around it, and this is only one of them. There's a number of applications out there or extensions to browsers which will allow you to do this. I haven't taken a look at any other than this one, custom new tab URL. Next. So once you install it, you end up with an icon there for, or when you go to the Chrome Web Store, you'll get Add to Chrome. Next. And then it'll be added to your extensions, and you get a little pop-up saying that it has been added. Next. And then to actually interact with it, it doesn't appear by default, and it really doesn't have to be pinned to your extensions portion of the toolbar. You really are probably only going to go into it once and customize it, and then you don't need to look at it again. So if you click on the icon for the extensions or go through the menus to get to extensions, custom, and you'll see your custom new tab URL is one of the options in there. You click the kebab menu, and you'll get a flyout menu, and you click on options. Next. And then it will be enabled by default, at least it was in my experience. But if it's not, make sure you put a check mark in the enabled. And then you'll see where you have URL or local file path. And you can put in any website or you can put in any of the Chrome pages that are listed below. I don't know why you would particularly want them to be your new tab option. But if you did want bookmarks to come up or something like that, every time you click on the new tab, you could select one of the Chrome pages. Next. But they say URL or local file path. Well, I was dismayed when I put in a local file path and it didn't work. Next. So if you want to access a local file, you have to go back in to manage the extensions. So you go to Extensions, Custom New Tab, hit the kebab menu, and go to Manage Extension. Next. And that'll give you a fairly long dialog box with all the different capabilities of it. It's worth exploring some of the other options that are available in there. But if you scroll down near the bottom, you'll see allow access to file URLs, and it will be disabled by default. So you have to enable that if you want to be able to access a local file rather than a web page. Next. And then once you do that, in the options, you can go to the URL or local file path, and you can just put in a path to a local file. You can put it in either as a URL, which is file colon slash slash slash, and then the path to it, or you can just put in the drive and directory in the file that you actually want to access. Next. So some of the examples, so for me, I like it manifest.app. So I put in HTTPS, full URL to it, and then the manifest note, browser note taker will appear every time I click on the new tab. Or your favorite website, or a local file. So a local file, you might have it, you create a local file that has web page links to all your favorite sites or whatever information you particularly want on that. As an HTML file, you can have it load every time you click on the new tab. Next. And this is my new tab in Chrome. And so you can see anytime that I click on that plus that you see over on the right-hand side, just underneath the E in the word Chrome, that's the new tab button or indicator. If I click on that, I will actually get manifest.app loading up with all of my notes there. Next. I think that is that it. Okay. So other browsers. So the custom new tab URL works in some browsers that are based on the Chromium engines. I tested it in Edge, Brave, and I suspect it might work in some other ones. If you browse to the Chrome Web Store using the browser you want the extension added to that URL, rather than adding it to Chrome, it will add it to whatever browser you happen to be in, whether it's Edge, Brave, or whatever. It does not work in Opera. So just a caution on that. And if Firefox, there is a custom new tab page extension specifically for Firefox. It uses a different rendering engine. And one difference in that is that it doesn't allow access to local files for the Firefox extension.
Next. A correction on that. You really don't need an extension in Firefox. There's a place in the settings where you can put in what you want to show in new windows and new tabs. And you can specify it, one or more. Because for a new window, you could actually, you may have a whole bunch of things. I don't know why or how it does it. I haven't used this. But Firefox, it has it natively. And they probably also support natively that file way of accessing a web page on your own computer.
Interesting that they actually have something in the Firefox, in the Mozilla add-on section that you can actually add it if it's not needed, unless it's a holdover from at some point that they didn't allow it or something like that, maybe. I'm not sure. Anyhow, interesting. Thanks on that. And basically, that's it for this. So anybody who wants to be able to customize the new tab experience, there you go. And did we lose Alan? Yeah, Alan, you're there. You stopped sharing. You're muted, Alan. There we go.
Sorry,
and that's it.
My internet just dropped out and then came back again.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think what happens there, Chris, that custom new tab page is a legacy extension. It used to work a number of years ago, and then Firefox, like many other browsers, disabled the ability to do to do local files as new tabs.
Okay.
I don't believe you can do that, and this extension doesn't work. I think I tried it.
Okay. Maybe before you post the PDF, you could correct that slide and indicate that Firefox allows random URLs but not local files.
I'll have to check that out again, but yes, I will.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, so Chris likes manifest.app, and I have a suggestion for some other note takers. And if you go to the menu in Windows, you'll find that there's a Windows utility, which is called Sticky Notes. And this is for all of those who used to put little yellow sticky notes on the display that had the password, the logon password. Sure, we all used to do that, didn't we? And this is an electronic version of that. So on the left-hand side is a thing that they call the notes list. And on the right, I'm showing you a sticky note on the display. And you notice that you have a menu bar. So you can customize the text somewhat, boldface, italic, that kind of thing. And you can have bulleted lists. And you can also include images. So it's quite a handy little app. And it's got a few more custom options. If you click on the, what's that, Chris? That's the meatball menu, right? The three horizontal dots.
Yep.
You click on that, then you get this pop-up menu here where you can select different colors for the note, and you can delete a note and so forth. So that's one that's built into Windows. And personally, I like this one, which is a third-party product called Stickies. It comes from this UK company. And it's freeware. It's got a lot more customization available, including different look and feel kind of thing, different skins, as they call it. You can resize the notes. You can change the text and the images. But the interesting thing is you can also set the thing to wake up at a certain time, or you can set an alarm or whatever. So the note will pop up and presumably sound an alarm. The notes stay where you put them and until you get rid of them. And when you reboot the machine, your note will still be where you left it. And you can snap notes together and line them up and make them look pretty. And if you use multiple computers, then you can also transfer notes from one machine to the other. So basically, when you install the app, it shows up in the taskbar in the additional apps menu, that chevron, the upward chevron, and the little yellow notepad there is the Stickies app. So if you right click on it, then you get this context menu, and you can see the first item there. You can add a new note, and then you can do all kinds of other things with it. So here's my version of an on-screen note. One of the nice things I think about this is if you really can't remember what you want to write down very quickly, the note's always on the screen. So all you have to do is click it and add some text. You can make them big or small, so they don't have to take all of your screen display, but they can be very handy. And again, they're customizable. So if you right click on the note, and you get some context menus here. I can change the font to all kinds of different fonts. I can change the color, the size, and so forth. So here's my note with a huge title, a highlighted subtitle, and then a bunch of lines of text. I actually don't. I do this Q&A agenda in Notepad++, but I do use Stickies for another purpose. I have this guy on my screen all the time, reminding me that I'm running as a metered connection, and that stops Windows generally from updating when it feels like. And this note reminds me that I should actually go and update the thing manually every now and again. And when I do that, I turn the metered connection off, and then I change the note to say that the connection is off. And that reminds me to turn the metered connection back on once I'm done. So those are a couple of other note options, and in particular the one that I like. And the final item we have tonight is Chris has a thing on Seek.
Yeah, so this is an interesting service that is available for Android or iOS. It's not desktop, but it identifies plants and animals using the camera on your phone. It is free. There are no advertisements. No internet is required for its basic functionality. Some of the additional functionality that Next actually does require an internet connection. So optionally, you can collect badges, complete challenges where they'll say, you know, identify three animals or, you know, various things like that. You can upload an image to iNaturalist, and there is, so if it can't identify something or you think it may have misidentified something, they have crowdsourced citizen scientists that may be able to identify an unknown species or misidentified species. You can contribute data on what you found with a single click. Next. There is a very good user guide that is available for download. And let me just paste in all this information here. Oh, that's the wrong one. Okay, I'll paste this in after I finish. So there is a good privacy note. They say no data is shared with third parties. Minimal data is collected, and they tell you exactly what will be collected under what circumstances, and the good information on that, which is always welcome. Next. So something that you'll see, so you point it at something and you can see where it says species and beneath it says chicory. So it's identified that particular plant. And then you can click on it and get information about it. Next. So you can view the species and it'll give you more information about it and the whole taxonomy and so forth. So it's actually a very, very comprehensive program to be able to identify plants or animals. Next. Okay, so there is a YouTube video that I linked to here, and we'll actually show it. It's only a two-minute video. And there's an additional 11-minute video that I found really useful of a user showing how he actually uses the app when he's out and about. So if you go next, Alan, we'll watch the quick video. So you can see where it says the species and it tells you what it found. And then another one, American robin. And here was really useful, domestic dog. But you can also find out about organisms. So, Alan's internet connection is acting up. There we go. So Japanese maple, and then you can dig down, get additional information about that particular thing, seasonality, where it's found, all kinds of stuff in there. And then you can do things like getting badges, you know, they look for, they'll give you challenges and so forth where you can try to find certain things. So here's where you have a mission, find certain things, you report them and you get these badges. They're worth what you paid for the app, but that's it. So very interesting if you like to be able to identify things. I'm typically where if it's brown, it's a tree. If it's colored, it's a flower. So this could allow me to actually identify things to a little bit better degree than that. So that's it.
Google Lens is another option.
Yep. This, I find, is a little bit more comprehensive than what Google Lens will actually give you. And it seems to be very complete in terms of what it can identify, other than domestic dog. But outside of that, really good information. Natalie points out for bird songs, calls, the Merlin app is great. So you can record a songbird or something like that and find out what bird is calling out. And Elizabeth says Seek is great. So that's good. Okay.
Okay, well, I think we've just finished our hour here. So rather than going into other questions, I didn't see anything new in the chat.
Nope.
Next Wednesday will be August the 7th, and that will be our next Q&A session. So if you have questions or topics that you'd like to share, and thanks to everyone tonight for their questions and shares. If you have things that you'd like to contribute, then just send us an email and we'll be pleased to add you to the agenda.
Elizabeth, I notice Elizabeth says, I have a question. If you could send it in, Elizabeth, we'll put it on the agenda for next week. That would be great.
And if you want your question or share to be anonymous, then you just have to ask and we can do that too.
If you don't say anonymous.
Thanks for tonight. And that's it for me.
If you do not say you want it anonymous, you will be credited with it. So just keep that in mind. Thanks, folks. And anybody who is interested more in the YouTube Health, there was a lot of chatter that was going on in the chat window. So if you're interested in that, you might want to go back. There's some useful information in there. I won't be hanging up the call for probably another 5 minutes or so. So if you go to the chat, you can actually go and save that to your local computer, or you can wait until it's posted on our website and pick it up from there. So thanks very much, folks. We'll see you next week.